Hi all you wonderful scuba divers out there, welcome to Scuba Diver Magazine Podcast. I'm Mark, a former dive instructor. It's been a long time since I've recorded a podcast. I skipped 1 week, but it feels like forever since I did a podcast. So lots has happened. Some of the news today is a bit dark and gloomy, unfortunately. I'm going to start off with quite a nice story, just to ease you into it. Then there's a few not so nice stories, and then I'm trying to bring it back, and we've got some new dive gear as well, something quite interesting that I think only the like nerdy scuba divers will get excited about, which is why I got excited when I found out about it. I had a nice chilled out, relaxed Christmas period and New Year's, spent a lot of time with family and just trying to rest and recover, as my son is now a month and a half old now. The lack of sleep is starting to set in, and I'm just getting used to that. And I'm also still trying to shake this cough that I had at the end of, towards the middle of December. I got sick with something, and now it's just this lingering cough. It's not COVID because I've tested myself, but it's just this winter cold that's going around because I just haven't really left the house in quite a while. So the one time I go out to see friends and I come back and I've got this lurgy sickness, whatever it is. But anyway, the first news story is quite a nice news story, and it's a new world record by a 12-year-old girl called Ellie Mae Rigg. And she's become the world's youngest master scuba diver by completing a set of specialty dives in Dubai, including a simulated rescue mission 21 meters underwater. This is from the nationalnews.com, the UAE version. So they very like sensationalize it. So she's from the UK. She's from Britain. She entered the Elite League of Divers on December 31st, which was her 12th birthday. And she beats out Toby, who was the previous world record holder from December 2020. So he completed his master scuba diver test in December 2020, the day after his 12th birthday. But Ellie did it on her 12th birthday itself. She says, "I'm very happy and very excited. Loved every bit of it." And she's now an MSD, a master scuba diver. So for those of you who don't know, a master scuba diver is Paddy's top recreational level, as it were. So instead of dive master, which is where you go down the professional level, the master scuba diver basically means that you've done rescue diver and 5 specialities. Now, the trick is that rescue diver, you have to be 12 years old to do your rescue diver. The specialities, most of them, they don't have age requirements. It's only things like cave and ice and that kind of stuff where you have to be a certain age. And you also have to have 50 dives in your logbook. So what she must have done is get all of those dives and the specialities all done before her 12th birthday, and then done the rescue diver course on her 12th birthday. They say that it started at 9 a.m. and she completed all the tasks by 5:30 in the evening. And her grandfather, who's a diver himself, told the National that her record can now only be matched, not beaten. But I kind of disagree with that statement, because technically, as long as someone can do it all in that single day before 5:30 in the evening, they can beat the record. So now it's just going to be a matter of some 11-year-old at the moment, or going on 12, is going to have to do their rescue course in before 5:30 in the afternoon. So they're probably going to start at 12:01 the morning of their 12th birthday, try and do the rescue course and get it done as early as possible to break this record. But no, well done to her. It's a big deal, especially considering her size. You see photos of her, she's a tiny little thing, but managed to complete the rescue course. And because she's done all the specialities as well, she's now a master scuba diver, which is pretty cool. I think I read somewhere that she wants to go into marine biology and all that kind of stuff. So she just loves being underwater and just being in and around the water. Congratulations to her. And we'll probably see some more of her name in the diving industry. The next news story is the loss of a scuba diving legend, which is Hans Keller. So Hans was the very first human to survive a 300 meter plus descent to the seabed and, of course, come back up. He has died in his home in Switzerland, aged 88. The deep diving pioneer's death came just 2 days short of 60 years since the famous Bell Dive took place off California's Santa Catalina Island on the 3rd of December 1962. The descent was not only record-breaking, but it was revolutionary in terms of making deep diving a practical proposition. Keller himself was born near Zurich in September 1934, but became interested in the idea of scuba diving only when he was 25. He was relatively old when he got into scuba diving, and at this point, he actually constructed his own underwater breathing device, but when, I think, on an interview, he reported that it worked very bad or very poorly. But while studying physics, mathematics, and philosophy at the University of Zurich, he met with Swiss physician Albert Bjorman. Now, if you know anything about scuba diving computers, you'll probably recognize the name Bjorman, because his work went to develop gas mixes to prevent decompression illness in divers and to create algorithms used in today's dive computers. The two of them together were really pioneers in like deep diving. So the two scientists collaborated to explore a theory that nitrogen narcosis might not be caused by nitrogen itself. In 59, Keller tested this on a 122-meter dive in Lake Zurich, breathing a 95% nitrox mix as he descended in an adapted oil drum, which was weighted down with stones. He went down, breathing this very oxygen-rich mix, and to be able to resurface, he had to cut the stones free with the dive knife, which was apparently quite hard, but it did manage to do it and completed the dive. 2 years later, he succeeded in carrying out an open circuit descent to 222 meters in the icy cold Lago di Maggiore, which is one of the Italian lakes. And he and Bjorman wanted to demonstrate that secret dive tables they've been developing using the IBM Center's computers could support such a descent followed by a safe resurfacing in no more than an hour. They were trying to work out how you could get to these very deep dives or deep depths and then come back up like as soon as possible, basically. And Keller and journalist Ken McLeish wore dry suits and full face helmets and breathed from stage mounted gas tanks, starting and finishing with 100% oxygen, and using three mixes from 9 meters, 50 meters and then 100 meters, they reached the bottom in 7.5 minutes and then resurfaced within that 1 hour as planned with no serious ill effects. Now, the attempt to pass beyond the 1,000 feet, that like 300 meter barrier, was the Atlantis dive in 1962, and that was part of the US Navy's Experimental Diving Unit, or NEDU, program of experiments into the use of mixed gases on deep dives. It was carried out using the Atlantis diving bell from the support ship Eureka, and Keller's dive buddy was British journalist Peter Small, the co-founder of BZAC, the British Subaqua Club, and also Triton magazine, the predecessor of Diver and, of course, DiverNet. At the maximum depth at 311 meters, Keller and Small switched from the gas inside of the diving bell to a mix supplied through their diving helmets, and they went outside to plant flags on the seabed, though Small got into brief difficulties through entanglement underwater. When they got back into the bell and switching back to the diving bell's mix, the divers expected to lose consciousness on opening their faceplates because they're switching mixes, but then to come around as the bell ascended. However, it seemed that Small had seen Keller pass out as he opened up his faceplates and froze and failed to switch back from his helmet supply, which I kind of get. If you see the guy next to you do something and he just immediately passes out, something in your like hind brain is going to tell you, don't do that. I don't want to do that because I might not wake up. The bell's ascent was paused from the surface at 60 meters because of a suspected leak. So they sent safety divers Dick Anderson and a 19-year-old British student, Chris Whitaker, they dove down to check for leaks in the bell, but they couldn't find the problem, and the pair then ascended before going back down, even though Whitaker knew that his inflation device was damaged. On their second attempt, they found that a fin tip was trapped in the bell's bottom hatch, and that was preventing a proper seal inside of the diving bell, and Anderson decided to stay with the diving bell. He then sent his buddy up to report to the surface, but Whitaker was never seen again. Keller actually regained consciousness and tried, but was unable to resuscitate Small. The bell was raised with the Swiss diver suffering no ill effects. So this risk-laden dive had proved tragic, but also monumentous for technical divers and sort of the proof of concept in the future in terms of managing deep dives. And Keller's depth record actually stood for 13 years, though in the aftermath of the Atlantis dive, he was actually dubbed the Hans Killer in some press reports. And he was also slammed for sharing gas mix secrets with sponsor Shell Oil, but not with a wider scientific community, although the criticism seems to have been unjustified because Buhlmann had in fact published those technical details. In later life, Keller went on to develop hyperbaric chambers for navvies and hospitals, and also produced diving suits, watches, and all sorts of other things, including a mechanical sea monster, I think I read somewhere, but it was a fledgling IT industry that next caught his attention in the 1970s. And by the middle of the 70s, he was selling his own Sesame line of computers, and later developed some of the earliest spell checking and language translation software. So very clever guy. He later joined the advisory board of the Historical Diving Society USA in 2009, and even in retirement, he continued to display his credentials as a Renaissance man, becoming both a fine artist and a concert pianist. The next news story is more news from the Conception boat fire. So a new grim insight into what happens during the fatal Conception liveaboard fire in California 3 years ago has emerged in the shape of footage recovered from one of the divers' mobile phones that's been recovered. So the FBI has shown a video clip to some of the relatives of the 34 divers who died in the lower deck bunk room on the 2nd of December 2019. The clip confirms that the victims were not overcome by smoke in their sleep, as initially reported, but they were actually struggling to find an exit as flames engulfed the vessel and smoke entered the bunk room. The 23-meter three-deck Conception was anchored off Santa Cruz Island when it caught fire in the early hours of the morning. Now, a report from the Los Angeles Times shows how the 33 guests and one crew member had awoken to find themselves trapped, their only exit routes being blocked by fire. The realization that at least some of the victims had been awake is reported to have arisen after shoes were found on bodies recovered from the charred wreck, and damaged cell phones were also found, and the video has been extracted by one of them by FBI forensic analysts. The phone appeared to have been deliberately placed in an area to be able to capture the scene, and the recording was made at 3:17 a.m., which was 3 minutes after Conception's captain, Jerry Boylan, had issued an emergency call and jumped into the water along with the four crew members who had been sleeping in the wheelhouse above the fire. By this time, flames had engulfed the main deck and the galley on the level above the bunk room. They were all sleeping in the lower deck, and the fire was now blocking the stairway and a small emergency hatch above one of the double deck bunks. The fire alarm is said to have been sounding in the video, with smoke seen bellowing from the ceiling fans and the stairwell itself. It's unclear whether the 24-second clip shown to the relatives who actually opted to see it was a segment of a more extensive clip, or whether that was just all that was recovered, but it's reported to reveal a relatively calm but increasingly desperate scene. One relative told the newspaper that although desperate to escape, the guests had maintained a calmness that perhaps reflected their experience as divers who were used to dealing with potentially dangerous situations. But another family member said that they died terrified, knowing that they were going to die. Even there at the end, they weren't giving up. They were trying to problem solve. A coroner's report has actually determined claimed that all 34 people died of smoke inhalation. The Conception has been exempted from the US Coast Guard escape route regulations because of grandfather rights. It was said to be considered impractical to impose the latest safety standards on older commercial vessels. So escape hatches at that time in 2019, they were supposed to be at least 81 centimeters wide and to have illuminated exit signs. Conception, however, because it was built in 1981, it only had a 61 centimeter hatch, no illuminated signs, although it's unclear whether this would have made a difference in the circumstances because of where the hatches were actually located and where the fire had spread from. But the Captain Boylan is facing seaman's manslaughter charges and was due to appear in court this month. Families of the victims are separately suing Conception operator Truth Aquatics and its owners Glenn and Dana Fritzler for wrongful death and negligence, and also the Coast Guard for wrongful death as a result of inspection failures because of this grandfather rights things. It's because the boat was so old, they kind of don't have to meet current safety guidelines, which is kind of bonkers. I think they have since readdressed this sort of issue to make sure that even old boats today are safe. But yeah, it is just another chilling reminder, and it really just sort of bring that news story back into the headlines that this this video clip has emerged. The last nasty news story for this week, I promise, is a British woman who was snorkeling from a dive boat off of the island of Cozumel in Mexico has sustained serious injuries after being struck by its propeller as she tried to climb back aboard. So this news story has a strong learning point to for everybody, because one of my, like, it's not even an irrational fear. Can it be a rational fear? Is boat propellers. But this is yoga instructor Amor Armitage, who had been snorkeling and freediving on a shallow reef on the 17th of December whilst her husband Chase, who was a stuntman working on a film in Mexico at the time, was out scuba diving with friends from that boat. So Amor was snorkeling and free diving just to whilst they were off scuba diving. She then started to feel cold and she swam back to the ladder, but says that music was playing on board the boat and the captain wasn't looking in her direction. Whilst holding onto the ladder, she had removed one fin when she realized that the boat had started to move. She has described what happened next. Now I'm going to go into a bit of gruesome sort of detail, so if you don't like gruesome details, probably skip forwards like 2 minutes. How she described the events: everything seemed to slow down as I feel the boat's propeller hitting my abdomen, genitals and legs. My body feels heavy and I see the boat moving away from me. The captain heard her scream, and on his instructions she managed to hold onto the ladder again, at which point he told her that she would have to pull herself aboard, and she said, I look down to see my insides out. I feel there's no chance that I can pull myself up alone. However, she reported that she did manage to haul herself up the ladder and lay on the deck of the boat as the scuba divers returned to the boat. Although she had suffered very deep cuts to her abdomen, medical staff later told her that she had been quite fortunate in sustaining a blood clot in her femoral artery, which is the big artery in your upper leg, in your thigh. So normally if you suffer that, you have minutes because blood drains from that so quickly. This blood clot, however, prevented her from losing a critical amount of blood before she could be taken ashore in the boat and to a local hospital. A four-hour operation later, surgeons worked to repair severe lacerations to both legs and her torso. Further major surgery was later carried out by a specialist from Cancun to deal with the blood clot. But following complications, Armitage was placed in intensive care and the surgeon had to return to carry out a third operation. At the start of the new year, she remained stable in intensive care, but still considered high risk, hoping to be able to return to the couple's home in Basingstoke in January. Having no insurance, however, for such an incident. They have so far raised, I think it was £100,000 through crowdfunding to cover the 60,000 plus hospital bills and repatriation costs already accrued, as well as the cost of an air ambulance home for a program of skin and bone grafts, and what could be a period, quite a long period of rehabilitation of at least 6 months, because Amor is a yoga instructor. So having these deep lacerations to both leg and abdomen, that's really tough. And she's got a lot of rehabilitation ahead of her. So two things that we can learn from this. The first thing is to boat captains, if you know that someone's snorkeling in the water around you, just take it really, really slow. Over the Christmas and New Year period, I've seen too many clips of like free divers and spear fishermen who see these speedboats coming towards them and they just have to duck under the water just to get away from the propellers. But if you have someone who's actually on your boat, I don't know whether they were paying customers or whether it was a friend's boat or whatever, but if you know that there are people in the water, especially snorkeling, you do have to look everywhere to see where they are before you even consider like turning that engine on. If you're in the water anywhere near boat propellers, be just double careful of where it is, where all of your limbs and everything is going around boat propellers. It's so easy, it's so quick and easy. Just for I was talking to one guy out in Sharm el Sheikh, and he had these scars all down his leg where he was holding onto the side of a rib in the water, getting ready to get back in. So equipment removal and all that. And holding on, he let his legs kind of drift up underneath the bottom of the rib. And then the rib must have gotten a little bit too close to the reef. So the boat handler just revved the engine a bit just to move them away. Of course, that just dragged his legs under and through the propellers. And now he has these huge scars down his legs. So just be incredibly, incredibly careful anywhere near boat propellers, and also double check your dive insurance. These costs can be life changing, and for the sake of a relatively cheap insurance policy, it's just going to cover you for a lot. I tend to dive with DAN Insurance, the Divers Alert Network. They, in my experience, have always been very good. I've seen so many testimonials about the Divers Alert Network insurance online. They're just wonderful, so definitely worth checking them out. And finally, the Go Diving Show, the British diving show in March this year, has announced a few more headliners. So we've got Andy Torbett and Ross Kemp are going to be there. So Andy Torbett is returning. He's going to be one of the hosts on the main stage. But this year, he's also working with the Thai cave rescue hero, Chris Jewell, to talk about the cave diving and exploration that they've been doing together. Over the past few years, the duo have actually teamed up to explore various cave systems, and they have big plans for the future, so they're probably going to elaborate about that. That's going to be on the Saturday, the 4th of March, 11:30 a.m. to 12:15 in the afternoon. So that's Andy Torbett and Chris Jewell. Ross Kemp is going to be, he has a show at 1:30 on the main stage, also on the Saturday, and on the Sunday, he's taking the 11:30 slot. So Saturday really is the day, but don't worry too much because there is plenty still going on the Sunday, the 5th of March. Ross Kemp is currently busy filming a second series of the Shipwreck Treasure Hunter TV series that first aired a while ago now, which was a fantastic wreck diving TV show around the British coastline for a more mainstream audience. It may be a bit like overly dramatic in places for scuba divers because it's aimed at like the general public who aren't scuba divers. So it really does help to like catch their attention. But yeah, it gets scuba diving on mainstream TV channels like Sky. It was a four-part series that saw Kemp dive on everything from the remains of a slave ship, the Iona II, which was discovered off of Plymouth, to the Kaiser's sunken Imperial fleet in Scapa Flow. I imagine he's going to be talking about the next series on the Saturday and the Sunday. So if you are planning on making it, Saturday, you'll get Andy Torbett and Chris Jewell as well, talking about cave diving exploration. But on the Saturday and the Sunday, you also get Ross Kemp talking about his scuba diving, what he's been up to. Onto new diving gear. So Nortec, if you've never heard of them, they make very nice valves for diving cylinders, and they're a German company. I love their valves to bits, and they released some like sneak peeks that they were doing something with Gary Dallas over the New Year period. And he released a pretty cool little short video of them announcing their new twin valves for twin cylinders. And these are the Apex, but spelt with an X, valves. And they come both in chrome plated brass, but also in their dark line, which is a matte black. Now, this is what I was talking about earlier, that like nerdy scuba divers will get excited about this, because when most people kind of look at it, they'll just see some, granted, slightly unconventional twinning valves with a manifold in the center, and that's kind of about it. They look well constructed, and some people will neglect the fact that in the I think it's the last line of the description, it has located opposite the hand wheel is a connection port for a stub pressure gauge or a dive computer transmitter with 7/16 inch connected thread. So in the manifold, the central pillar between the two tank valves is actually a high pressure port that you can mount either a button gauge or a wireless air transmitter, which I think is pretty cool. And that's the kind of the nerdy scuba diver inside of me getting kind of excited about one little thread, because otherwise, yeah, the manifold is kind of a almost waste of space. And if you do dive with a transmitter, it typically has to go on one of your first stages, which can make it a little bit clunky because they're a bit wide. They can get in the way of some of the hoses. Whereas this is a very elegant solution to be able to maintain that that wireless air transmitter and keep it in a pretty sensible space. So yeah, they're not cheap. I think I looked at the Darkline version and it was over $1,000 just for the actual tank valves. They are nice tank valves. They can, I think, if you want to, they can come in a proper briefcase, which is what Gary Dallas is like in the video, what he's collecting. He's like this high end, like almost arms dealer or something. And they pass him the suitcase. He opens it up just like in Pulp Fiction. And he's just like, yes, I like what I see. And it is a pretty nice briefcase. I don't think it comes as standard. I think you can buy it with, which seems a little bit indulgent for tank valves, because it's rare that you'll ever disassemble them. But if you've got some money to burn and you want some very nice tank valves for your twin sets, definitely check out Nortec. So that's Nautec.de. And there was another recall on the XDeep regulator, the NX700 regulator. So this is on the 28th of December. And in a Facebook post, XDeep states, "Recalls are always tough. However, safety is most important. We inform with the responsibility that all NX700 regulators are being removed from the market due to an identified potential life safety issue. The quality assurance program received one report of a first stage with a broken turret connection screw, which resulted in a complete turret failure. Once we were informed, we immediately tried to recreate the failure to fully understand the root cause, but were unfortunately not successful. We do, however, believe that the screw could fail in case of external impact, like a falling tank, or even after many working cycles due to mechanical stress. This leads us to conclude that the screw is potentially not strong enough, forcing us to rethink its components engineering completely. Pushing the envelope with a truly innovative design comes with the risk that despite working with an experienced manufacturer, CE approval, and rigorous testing, certain manufacturing issues may still be discovered through our continued quality assurance program following the product's release to a broader audience. If you own an NX700 regulator, please stop using it immediately and contact your dealer where you have purchased your unit, or directly by contacting us at support@xdeep.pl. Please follow this link to get full information about the details and the entire process. And I'll pop a link down in the description below, and it leads to a PDF that basically breaks down everything and what can do. So this is unfortunate for the NX700. I think this is the second recall notice that they had on the regulator. It's still quite new. XDeep are quite new to the regulator market, and the NX700 is very different to any other first stage out there. So teething problems, and they've made plenty, but the fact that just one has gone wrong, and they're taking such a serious stance on, you know what, no, we're going to recall these and we're going to sort it out. It's kind of sad, because it is such a nice regulator. And hopefully it's going to be a quick fix for them to either change, hopefully just the material, if they make this connection screw, whatever it is, the bolt that holds the turret together, out of a different material. If they have to redesign the entire body, that's going to be much, much more work to do. If you dive an NX700, click on the link down in the description below and get in contact with XDeep. Finally, onto videos that have released over the past 2 weeks, I suppose now. This section might be a little bit longer, but I'll try and be brief to get through them. So the first one was the top 10 scuba diving accessories. So this was actually asked for by one of you wonderful people, the audience. They asked what would be like my top like diving accessories. So I actually decided to turn it into a top 10 video. And yes, in it we're talking about all sorts of like gear, and when it comes to scuba diving, it's less like exciting when you talk to like accessories, because it's the little things, and it usually comes down to like dry bags, for example. So dry bags, an amazing accessory for a scuba diver, and having multiple dry bags, because it means that you can organize your equipment and you can keep separate things inside dry. So when you open up your main kit bag on the deck of a boat, of course that's going to be the moment that a rogue wave just sprays all over everything. So if you've got your phone, your wallet, your keys, and all that kind of stuff in your main bag, then they're just going to get drenched. So all of that goes in a small dry bag. So that's my like surface essentials dry bag. I then have a separate one that's for other bits and bobs, so tools and like replacement parts. And the more dry bags you have, it just allows you to compartmentalize and keep things organized. It also helps at the end of the dive because your gear, especially like your BCD and your dry suit or your wetsuit, they take hours to drip dry. So if you can stow them away in a dry bag, it means they're not going to leak into the boot of your car or however you get back. And then it's all contained inside. And then when you get home, you can wash them, you can hang them up properly. Other things, again, thinking about like hanging up, a decent coat hanger. I mean, not an actual coat hanger. We get like dry suit and wetsuit specific hangers. They're always useful, but yeah. Top 10 scuba diving accessories. There's a video out now that went live like mid to late December. Then AskMark had a change over the like Christmas period because behind the scenes we were looking at like different ways to like improve things and change things, go to a broader audience, and there seems to be a big move on YouTube with a lot of other channels to more shorts, more easily digestible content. I know Sean used to hate the word content, but I'm going to use it. So videos which are just shorter and just easier to like watch on the go. And also there's a shift to vertical as well, so that you can watch it on your phone in full screen without having to tilt it sideways, which is very alien to me. I've always filmed horizontally. I know a lot of people prefer that. However, to be able to do a lot of the shorts and different like formats, it's better if you film vertically. So just experimenting with that. But also, instead of having five or answering five questions all at once on a Sunday, I'm doing like two or three questions over the like entire week, and it's one video per question. So for example, over the Christmas period, on Christmas there was a big that I think that was like the final five question Ask Mark, where I was they were asking about free diving after scuba diving, which is quite a serious no-no, and four other questions. But then between Christmas and New Year's, there were three individual questions, if that makes sense. Free diving after scuba diving, for those of you who don't know, big no-no, because if you get out after a scuba dive, remember that you still have dissolved gases in your tissues. You're still decompressing when you're on the surface as such. So you're still like returning to normal. But if you then jump in the water snorkeling and you dive down really down deep and then come back up because you're only breath hold, then yeah, some of those dissolved gases in your tissues can come out of solution too fast and you can end up with a decompression illness. So no, the current guidelines I think are after a single dive you got to wait, I want to say 12 hours, and after multiple dives it's 18 hours. But if you can leave it longer, it's safer. You can snorkel on the surface. You can be on the surface, but don't dive down. But also post scuba dive, it's worth staying out of the water just to check yourself for signs of decompression illness, just in case something happened on the dive. At least you're like on dry land and you're surrounded by people. I think that was actually part of, or a second part of the question is like, oh, if I'm not feeling well enough to go on the second dive, can I just snorkel? And it's like, well, if you're not feeling well enough for the second dive, then they could be signs or symptoms of decompression illness. So it's best to stay out of the water altogether and tell people that these are the signs and symptoms that I'm feeling, so that they can take appropriate action and monitor you for decompression illness. Someone was asking about, is it worth getting into servicing scuba diving equipment? And that's kind of a tricky question because it depends where you're located. Because here in the UK, we're quite strict as far as who can service or at least get hold of servicing parts for regulators and BCDs and all that kind of things. We have like two separate grades almost of like replacement parts. Some replacement parts you can buy from a dive center. Chances are they might not have them in stock if you just walk in, but if you ask them, they can get hold of them and sell them to you. However, there's another grade of replacement parts. It's normally like the internal bits that won't have a recommended retail price because you can't, at least here in the UK, you can't sell them to or directly to the customer. It's something that you, the dive center, and the servicing technician have to fit for the customer. As far as I know, it's all to make sure that someone doesn't reassemble their regulator incorrectly and then hurts themselves. And like cowboy servicing technicians, it's all in aid to like try and reduce that. But I think in some other countries they're a bit more liberal as far as, yeah, of course you can service your own regulators as long as you've got the technical know-how and the tools and stuff. But as far as making it a career, yeah, you're probably not going to make a huge amount doing it unless you have a particular niche and there's a high concentration of scuba divers in the area who have a need for that servicing. But also it's per brand here in the UK. So how it basically works is you have to work for a dive center. The dive center has to be a registered dealer for that particular brand. And then you can go on a servicing course, and they only run them once, maybe twice or something in a year. Apex are quite good. I've done a few of their servicing courses and they're online, which it has its pros and cons. I did an Apex course years and years ago, like 2009, 2010, and that was in person. So you went to a dive center and they had a servicing technician from Apex, had all the regulators and things, and you would disassemble them and you would reassemble them, and he'd tell you like what all the different parts do and how to fix things and do all that kind of stuff. Whereas when it's digital, it's convenient for everybody because it's all like you don't have to go anywhere, and they don't have to have a training technician go out to you or whatever. And it was quite a useful resource because you can then refer back to it, and it will walk you through if you haven't serviced a certain second stage in a while or whatever, and you forget which bit goes where, you can go through it again as opposed to do it from memory. So that was quite convenient, but it is quite nice if you do have all the things like in front of you that you can disassemble. But yeah, so getting back to the original question, yeah, it can be a lucrative thing, but you're just qualified to service that brand. And in some cases, that particular regulator, you then have to go on a different course to do a different brand. And it can be quite time consuming and costly to get every single ticket so that you can service just any regulator. Then you've got to get hold of the parts. Then you've got to think about like insurance liability and all that to make sure that you're covered, and all of the specialist tools, because some regulators have very unique tools. And if you don't have it, then chances are you're going to damage the regulator trying to undo this one particular part that needs this specific tool. So yeah, it can be done. It's better if you like join up a dive center and become a member of their servicing crew. But to do it freelance, yeah, it can be done, but you've got to compete with like other freelance and other dive centers in the area. So it's a matter of, yeah, it can be done, but it can be quite tough. Next one was a bit more specific. They were asking about which wetsuit was best for scuba diving in Florida. They were moving from the West Coast. I think they lived in California, but now they're relocating to Florida, and what thickness wetsuit. And that's going from like an 8mm to a 3mm. But I think you could still make use of that 8mm in the colder winter periods in Florida. Someone's asking about a pre-dive lever and how that works. And that's, I really got my, sank my teeth into that one. It's, and I did turn that into a separate video that's due to go live on the 7th of January. And the pre-dive lever, or the Venturi switch, as I usually call it, is a very useful switch on a regulator second stage. And all it's there to do is to interrupt a free flow. So most regulators nowadays are what we call downstream. So if something fails, if a certain O-ring slips or a part jams or whatever, it's designed to fail in an open position. So it won't like shut off and stop delivering gas. It's going to deliver too much gas. So at least you can still breathe from it and make it back to the surface. But the downside is, because you've got 200 bar of pressure inside of that cylinder that then gets regulated down to about 10 bar of pressure inside of the hose, 10 bar of pressure is still quite a lot. And it's all designed to be downstream. So it's going to deliver so much gas that even if you press the purge button, especially in cold water, you get the Venturi and the Bernoulli effect, which effectively creates a vacuum inside of the second stage. As soon as any gas runs through it, that the second stage, if it's out of your mouth, it thinks that you're still taking a breath, so it still delivers gas, and then it opens the valve even more, that lets even more gas coming through, and it becomes an exponential free flow. So it's just gas going everywhere. What the Venturi switch does is it basically ruins the efficiency of the second stage. So it covers up the air outlet inside of the second stage and scatters the gas, so it's less efficient and it doesn't create that vacuum inside of the second stage. And you can still breathe from it. It's going to make it a little bit harder to breathe from, but most divers won't really. It's negligible. You're not going to notice it. If you put it on like a proper ANSTI test machine, you'll see the difference with the Venturi switched on and the Venturi switched off. However, it will interrupt a free flow before it forms. Without the Venturi switched on, if you lower a second stage with the mouthpiece upwards into water, it will bubble. And then if you put it down even deeper into the water, it's just going to free flow. However, when the Venturi is switched on, as long as you do it like right, there's still a chance that it will free flow, but it's much more controlled and easier to stop. So Venturi switches and pre-dive switches, they're basically on or off, because was it Oceanic? They used to have one that had like it clicked as you rotated the lever from on to off. And because it clicks like two or three times, some divers thought, oh, I like it like two clicks forwards. It's either on or off. There's no like middle ground. I mean, I suppose there is a bit of a middle ground, but yeah, it's on or off. But yeah, it's basically, if that second stage is out of your mouth, you should have the Venturi switch switched on, or switch to pre-dive, and then as soon as the second stage goes into your mouth, you switch it off, and it just helps to reduce the work of breathing. So yeah, that was a really interesting like technical question that I could get my teeth into, and yeah, that is going to be a longer like how to, or how the Venturi switch works. There was a top 10 video on weird discoveries, or weird underwater discoveries. That was just something a little bit different that I wanted to try out, see how it did online. And it was just underwater statues, and underwater, I think someone found like a giant eyeball the size of a fist, which was pretty cool. The Antikythera mechanism, which is this weird ancient Greek like clockwork box that someone found, and they've managed to work out it's basically a handmade and hand cranked celestial calendar, which is just incredible. They found it in a shipwreck off, I think, Antikythera is the name of the islands, and just other bits and bobs. Someone's asking what they should put in their Saver Dive kit, more specifically for dry suit diving. And then the only thing there is, it helps if you have silicone seals on your dry suit, because you can swap them over really quickly. Otherwise, as far as dry suit goes, it really comes down to just like talc or the like Neo Slicks or something. It's a water-based lubricant, and that helps get the seals on without like pulling and tugging, because you're going to rip a cuff or a neck seal. Otherwise, yeah, glues and patches, those kind of kits, they're nice, but they're not going to save like a dive if it's in a couple of hours, because a lot of the glues take 24 hours at least to set. I mean, the McNett, or I think they call themselves Gear Aid today, they sell like accelerants for their adhesives so that they actually set much faster, but still it's like within a day. So it's really something that you have to do at home, and then you're not diving for at least a day, and then you got to like test it. You got to leak test it to make sure it's not leaking still. But yeah, Save a Dive kits, it's one of those things that you pick up over the years. You're like, oh, I could really do with one of these. And then you add that to your dive kit. And then, yeah, every time you experience some new issue, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, let me add that as well. Until you get this like super Save a Dive kit that has a little bit of everything. Someone was asking an interesting question about, it was on the video of the Apple Dive Watch Ultra, the new one, because that's got scuba diving features inside of it. It's effectively a scuba diving computer as well as an Apple Watch. And they said, oh, do I need to like enter my cert card number or something to be able to unlock these scuba diving features, or are they open to just Joe Public to just, oh, I got a scuba diving computer, let me go scuba diving. And it's, well, yeah, but the same with all scuba diving equipment, especially with online retailers nowadays. You can buy a complete set of scuba everything and assemble it yourself, go on a scuba dive. It's not the smartest thing to do if you're unqualified, but there's nothing like legally from stopping you doing that. Ethically and like morally, yes, there's something to stop you, because it used to be at the dive center, someone would walk in and you could tell they were unqualified, because they seemed really uncomfortable. They didn't know like any of the like official terms. It used to be like boat owners who wanted a small scuba set to jump in the water and cut their propeller free. If they ran over some rope or something, it would foul up their propeller and they'd have to get in the water. It's only like less than a meter underwater in a lot of cases. But still, it's so dangerous. So we used to have to be able to convince them that it wasn't the best idea. Yes, they'd go away frustrated, but at least they weren't gonna like entangle themselves and drown. So yeah, when it's in a dive center, it's quite easy to be able to like convince them otherwise. But online, no, there's nothing to stop someone. And that's really what they used to do back in like the 60s or whenever. Yeah, they just used to make their own dive equipment, like Hans Keller from the first story, or the second story. He learned to dive and he made his own regulator and his own dive equipment. It was just like the done thing. They weren't qualified to do any of this kind of things. The qualifications didn't exist. So they made their own stuff. If you look at Alec Pierce's scuba channel, he has like all this dive equipment and like magazines like Popular Mechanics that would break down and show you how to build certain scuba diving equipment at home with things. So yeah, they would just dive with whatever. I used to hear one story at the dive center that I used to teach at. There was one of the good old boys from the like original diving years, and he would turn up with like this what used to be a propane tank, and he used to get that refilled. And of course, whenever He'd bring it in to be filled. The filler would kind of like, no, are you kidding? But people who actually knew him is like, oh no, that's, I forget his name now, but that's Frank. He knows what he's doing. Don't worry, I'll fill it up for him. So, yeah, it was just like a different world. But today, no, you don't need any like license to buy the equipment, because if it was for like a gift, a Christmas gift, you're feeling particularly generous, you're buying your other half a dry suit or a regulator or something, or even a dive computer, yeah, there's no like requirements, there's no like, you don't have to prove that you're qualified. It's just, yeah, I'd like to buy this dive computer, please, thank you very much. It's a gift. Or if it's online, you don't even have to explain yourself at all. The most that you have to, like here in the UK, with dive knives, you need proof of age. You have to be over, I think it's 18, to be able to buy a dive knife, which does make online retail kind of tricky. You have to ask for like a picture of their driver's license or something. Or a lot of the couriers nowadays, they have a system where to be able to deliver it, they have to see proof of, they have to see your ID before they deliver the package, because it has either alcohol or knives or something inside of it. But there's really nothing stopping just anyone from buying a full set of scuba equipment and jumping in the water, other than common sense, which seems to be lacking in today's day and age. But yeah, that is an interesting question that was asked. And there's nothing that we can do other than like recommends to unqualified want to be divers. No, it's best if you get qualified first before investing in scuba equipment. And I think that's about it. So yeah, the new like format of Ask Mark is going to be vertical, and it's going to be a lot shorter. I'm going to try and extend it to 8 minutes, because I used to, when it was like 5 videos, I'd record them all at the same time, and it would get quite like tiring to record that much all at once. So, and I didn't want it to be like an hour long, because I'm spending like 20 minutes on each question just rambling on. So, starts off, they're like 4 or 5 minutes. I'm going to try to extend it probably to about 7 or 8 minutes, just so that I can spend a bit more time elaborating on them. But yeah, it seems to be going well. They seem to be well received, and yeah, you'll start to see it in like shorts as well. So very small content, as opposed to like 4 or 5 minutes. It's going to be like 60 seconds, and probably on different social media platforms as well. But otherwise, that's about it. So yeah, happy New Year, everybody. Hopefully, you had a nice time off, and hopefully the relatively warm weather here is continuing on for everyone else. I think we got some cold weather on the way. I don't have any dives planned, because I want to get over this cold or cough or whatever it is before I get back into the water. But yeah, if you're diving over this period, just double check, make sure everything's nice and safe. Stay away from boat propellers, please, everybody. And yeah, thanks for listening, and safe diving.